All right. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of GTI Insights, the Global Taiwan Institute's policy podcast. My name is Marshall Reed, and I'm a program associate here with GTI.
And I'm Adrian Wu, an intern at GTI.
And today we're so thrilled to be joined by Tuhi Martukaw, a Taiwanese indigenous rights activist, journalist, and founder of the Lima Taiwan Indigenous Youth Working Group. In addition to all her work with Lima, Tuhi has in the past served as co-chair of the Global Indigenous Youth Caucus, a group which was recognized by the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues from 2010 to 2015. Throughout her career, she's really worked to advance the cause of Taiwan's indigenous communities, both within Taiwan and around the world. Tuhi, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hello, Ina Bayan.
Well, Tuhi, I'm so glad you could join us today to discuss all your work and activism at such an interesting time. Unfortunately, really around the world, indigenous groups in many countries continue to lack the proper recognition, both from their federal governments, from their societies. And despite increasing efforts from groups like yours, the same is often true in Taiwan. However, there seems to be a growing awareness of the important role Taiwan's indigenous communities play throughout Taiwan society. As President Tsai mentioned in her address on this year's Indigenous Peoples Day, quote, "Indigenous peoples have also achieved great things in government, industry, national defense, and on the front line of our pandemic response. These accomplishments should all be recognized and valued." To this end, we're so grateful to have you here to share your insights on how connections with and among Indigenous communities can be strengthened and how we can address the challenges facing Indigenous Taiwanese today. So thank you for joining us. So just to begin, I always like to kind of set the stage a little bit and get a little background on your work and, you know, what are the issues that you're focusing on? So I'd love to hear a bit about Taiwan's indigenous communities and your work with them. And for our listeners, both in Taiwan and international listeners who may not know so much about the situation facing Taiwan's indigenous people, you know, could you give a little background and how are you working with these peoples?
Okay. Well, again, in Mayan, that's hello in my language. I'm from the Binmayan peoples, and which is located in the east part of Taiwan, and I'm from the community called Gasafagan. It's a very ancient community that lasts for our interim chief. He is the 69th generation of our traditional chief. So yeah, I'm from a very ancient community. And as you mentioned about like this background of indigenous peoples in Taiwan, I will say that, well, the first thing people should really remember or to really know is that indigenous peoples in Taiwan, we are still under colonization. So first, like in the 17th century, when Dutch and Spanish came to Taiwan, of course, they are like the first settlers to Taiwan. And then they started the very first colonial kind of ruling in Taiwan, especially toward indigenous peoples. And then that was the Ming Dynasty, when Zheng Chengong and his followers or his military came to Taiwan. And then that's another kind of encounter of Taiwan indigenous peoples to outsiders. And then that's the Qing Dynasty. And after end of the 18th century, the Qing Dynasty started to really like started more proactive controlling of Taiwan. It's not only to indigenous peoples, but to all the people in Taiwan at that time. And that I would say, starting from that time, we've encountered a lot of slaughters and massacres regarding this ruling regimes in Taiwan. And then that was the Japanese colonization for 50 years. And then KMT came to Taiwan. They built, nowadays it's a Republic of China in Taiwan. So with all these histories, we are all subject to those who have power. And until today, too, even though President Tsai, she apologized to indigenous peoples in 2016, And then every year on the Indigenous Peoples Day or other important national days, she would say something or address something regarding Indigenous peoples. But still, as for example, she mentioned about, or she talked about that a lot, that a lot of Indigenous people are serving in the army, you know, but that is also the result of colonization, because in the past, we can just live our life or have our support our livelihood in the mountains or by oceans or by river. But because of all these colonial regimes that change our lifestyles and so also bring money to our daily lives. So we have to earn money in order to survive. In the past, we don't have this kind of concept of money or currency, but now we have that. And because our background, like live in the more natural setting, so we kind of have better ability to adjust to different circumstances or to different environment. And that gives us the advantage to serve in the army, but also because of the past high pressure on Indigenous peoples, especially during the Japanese colonization. During that time, as we all know, Japanese army or the administrative regime, they really put a lot of effort, we'll say, in a more positive way, but actually they put a lot of force on Indigenous peoples because we did fight back hardly at that time. And so they kind of, because of this history, that it creates or it led to the result that we think to be in the military or to serve as government staff members or to become teachers, you know, it's more stable and we can have higher social status. And then we don't have to be so afraid of all this oppression from the government, from the authority. So, you know, like when we are saying that a lot of Indigenous peoples are serving in the military and we are really contributing to protect this country. But this is also the result of colonization. And we can see that a lot, like during our daily lives. And also, for example, that I'm growing, actually, I was born in the community, but I grew up in Taipei City. I grew up in the urban area. And throughout my the time of my teenager years, it's always very weird for me when I'm introducing myself to others saying that, oh, I'm indigenous person, but I'm half-half and I live in Taipei and I don't speak my language. And people will really question me as like, okay, you say you are indigenous, but how can you prove it? You don't speak your language. How dare you can say that you are indigenous since you don't speak your language? But the reason why I grew up in Taipei and the reason why I cannot speak my language, that's also the result of colonization. It's not that I don't want to learn my language, it's that with all this environment or our policy or all the results of the colonial experiences of my parents, my grandparents, that result in the outcome of me as an indigenous person, but without the ability to speak my own language. So I was, it's a bit complicated. I'm sorry if I cannot make it like to explain it more clear. But anyway, I just want to really express that, you know, for us, even though now in Taiwan, of course, like it's more of a democratic society. And of course, if we talk about political involvement or our participation in the politics, in election and all the things, it's a lot better than I would say like even just 5 years ago. Because I will have to say when President Tsai came to the office, it's different. But still, it's still we still have to improve a lot.
Yeah, thank you so much for that historical overview and just, you know, really expressing some of the struggles and pain from colonization that, you know, the indigenous community has faced. So with Lima Taiwan Indigenous Youth Working Group specifically, which you co-founded, it focuses on building connections between Taiwan's indigenous people. Can you talk a bit about Lima's mission and how Lima works to further its goals?
Why we started is it has to be traced back to my first experience in the United Nations. That was in 2006, and I was in third year of my college study, and I was by accident somehow, like I was invited to go to the Permanent Forum, and actually I was majoring in diplomacy in National Chengdu University. So of course, international relations and United Nations systems and all these things, or different like international mechanisms or international treaties were the things I had studied. So at that time, I thought I should be in a better, have better foundation than others to attend this this forum. But when I was there in the United Nations and at this forum, it's called Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, and of course, it focuses on indigenous issues, and it will have like 2,000, 3,000 people from around the world to join to take part in the forum. And when I was there, I literally cannot understand what is going on, even though like sentence by sentence or word by word I can understand what people are talking about, but when all this are combined together, I really don't know what the hell is going on. So I was really shocked at that time that, for example, when people were talking about that was 2006. So when people were talking about the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which was then adopted next year in 2007, but in 2006, it was already very clear that it will be adopted very soon. So people were talking about all these articles, the different concepts, and then people were talking about climate change. And also because Taiwan passed the Basic Law on Indigenous Peoples in 2005. That was very, very advanced step internationally, because really until now, not so many countries have this certain kind of law that is specifically protecting or guarantee the rights of Indigenous Peoples. Especially we have this title, Basic Law, that give it a very special status, like in this legal framework, or it should be that. It should be like that, but of course we know in reality it's not. But anyway, it was a huge progress when people know about that Taiwan has this kind of law, because, you know, until now, not so many people, even indigenous peoples, they don't really know we do have indigenous population in Taiwan. So in 2006, there are people asking me about this basic law, and also asking me about like the history of indigenous peoples in Taiwan, and how can we have this process, how do we push for our rights movement so that we can have this kind of law passed and all these things. I really cannot say anything about it because I know nothing. At that time, I knew nothing about it. But then when people ask me, okay, so you say you are from Taiwan, then what's the difference between Republic of China and People's Republic of China, so PRC and ROC, what's the difference? I can really tell them the story of this civil war between National Party and also the Chinese Communist Party and all this, you know. I can even tell the different names of the battles, because we learned that and we had to memorize it during our high school years. That's something we were forced to learn. So for my past 20-something years, I've never really learned my own history, but I learned other people's history. I cannot do that anymore, but at that time, I can name the rivers in China, but I cannot really tell the name of the rivers just in Taidong, where I came from, my hometown. So this is a very shocked experience I had at that time. So I started to think that I have this kind of experience, and it's kind of like a like enlightenment to me to really think about my own identity and to really think about that. If I am going to tell people that I'm indigenous person, I have indigenous heritage, what is my heritage? It's not, it should be in me, but it's not there yet. So I have to find it back. But what if we can have a kind of process or kind of stimulation to younger generations? So for younger generations like me who grew up in Taipei or growing up in an environment that is not that close to our own cultures, we can still have this possibility to get to know ourselves, and we can have this process happen a bit earlier. So, but I have this idea at that time, but because then I went abroad for a study and all these things. It was only until 2011 I came back to Taiwan and started to get to know more young people. And then I found some friends that who have the same idea, shared the same idea with me. That's why we started or we founded Lima Taiwan Indigenous Youth Working Group in 2013. Even though like one of the major tasks for Lima is to take part in the international events or conference like the indigenous like the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. But more important thing what we are trying to do is that to be able to participate in the international conferences, it's like a goal. But more important thing is the process. How can we equip ourselves to have the ability and capacity to take part internationally? And that needs not like English ability, of course, it's important, but we do have these examples, or I like myself, I have this experience that I can speak English, but I cannot speak concrete content to share with others because I know nothing about my own culture and the history or these experiences of indigenous peoples in Taiwan. So more importantly is that we have to really equip ourselves with all this knowledge that we cannot learn at schools. And also we have to really get to know ourselves, because for all of these statements or all these ideas we are sharing internationally, that should be solid founded in the discussions among indigenous youth or among different indigenous groups. That will not come, it should not come from our imagination, because a lot of times we'll think, oh, maybe it's better for us like this, but we don't live in that reality. So we cannot really image what will really happen if we put something like this in force. So even though like the one of the important tasks is for us to participate in all this in the international events, more importantly is how can we, before we go internationally, we have to stand firmly on our own soil. And with that, we can have the strength to go to the world and talk to the world. So I would say that most of my friends now, or like the co-founders now, most of them, they went back to their own communities now to really work with their own people with these experiences of international participation.
Sure. Well, thank you again for such a good overview. I mean, I think it's such an interesting dynamic between Lima's work internationally, and like you said, it's so important to work domestically on your own soil. And I want to go back to something that you said a bit earlier, that you've mentioned this in other interviews, particularly with a recent one you did with the National Democratic Institute, that you do feel like there has been this sort of gulf in the past between your life as an Indigenous woman and in the Indigenous communities and your life in Taipei and your life as a Taiwanese person. But you've also mentioned that, I'm glad you brought up Indigenous youth earlier, that this line is being blurred a little bit more by Indigenous youth, that they are more connected between those two previously separate worlds. But I don't know if that's quite as true for Taiwanese politicians, policymakers, you know, despite the fact that President Tsai is of indigenous descent and has apologized in the past, there has still been sort of this disconnect between Taiwanese, the Taiwanese political sphere and the indigenous communities. So, you know, given your work in these communities, do you have any advice for Taiwanese policymakers or even, you know, other indigenous youth or people about how to strengthen this connection between the indigenous communities and the Taiwanese political sphere? And, you know, how can indigenous knowledge and culture and history be blended more effectively with Taiwanese policymaking?
I would say, well, that should be like in, well, I will talk about this in two parts. The first part, I want to go back to ourselves first, as indigenous people or indigenous youth especially, is that because, you know, in the past, we always think that if I want to be like a real indigenous person, I have to be live in the community. Otherwise, I'm fake. Or otherwise, I'm like distant from my own culture. Of course, in some circumstances, that's true. But I will say for my own experience, I will not say that, even though I still live in Taipei for most of my time. But because I think, around that time, like 2011, when I came back to Taiwan after my master's study, I started to go back to my own community like at least once in 2 or 3 weeks. And then the more important thing is not I went back so often. It's more because I work with the youth in my community, with my specialties, my expertise. It's not that, of course, for example, like the youth in the community, they know the culture more than I do. It's no doubt about that. They can speak the language very fluently, or they can communicate with the elders, and they know like the context of a lot of things or history in the community. And that is something I don't have. Of course, I'm learning about it. But more important thing is that that's their expertise. And I do have my own expertise, for example, because I'm political majored. So I can know about like the different policies or different laws, what does that mean and what kind of effect it can result to and all these things. So we combine our expertise to work in a community together with the goal that, or with the aim that we discuss together and come up with. So with that, even though I don't physically live in the community, but I do still live in the context of the community. So why I want to say this is that still a lot of people think, especially indigenous youth who didn't grow up in the community, they will say that, for example, one day when I finish my college study or master's study, then I'm more capable of doing something, then at that time will be my time to go back to the community. But why do we have to wait? And also, it's not that we have to visit. Of course, it will be good that we can physically be in the community, but that is not the only possibility we can have. There are a lot of ways for us to connect the communities and our studies or our expertise or our work. And if we can do that, then we are not restricting or limiting ourselves in this thought that I'm not in the community, so I can do nothing. So this is one thing, that how can we ourselves to connect ourselves or to change this kind, to make it more blur of this boundary. And the other thing to the mainstream society or the political or the politicians, I will say that a lot of times they will think because they don't understand indigenous cultures, they don't know the context, so they will leave it to indigenous politicians. But I will have to say, to have indigenous status doesn't equal to have indigenous identity. That's two things. So some people, by law, they are indigenous people, but by identity or by their worldview, they are not. And to be very honest, some of the indigenous politicians, they are like this. They do have the, by law, they are indigenous, but by our law, they are not. So what, and for non-indigenous politicians, it's also a learning process. They don't, for my own observation, I would say a lot of them, they are so afraid of offending indigenous peoples. So they tend not to address indigenous issues. But well, I have to say that all the issues on this island, everything, every policy, that matter to us because we are also Taiwanese. We are also living in this country. So every decision a politician made are relevant to us. So for the politicians, I will say that, okay, first you recognize or you acknowledge yourself that you don't really understand indigenous issues or indigenous livelihood or indigenous knowledge or these things. Fine. First, acknowledge that. Second, just learn it. And just like we have to learn a lot of different like ideologies, or we learn, like, for example, politicians, they also learn about other countries' policies. And that's the same. Why you can learn about American laws, but you don't want to learn about indigenous cultures in Taiwan? It's not that different, you know, and it's not that difficult, I would have to say. And a lot of us were very willing to discuss with you. And just imagine that we are, of course, we are different, but everyone is different. So why are you so afraid of getting closer to indigenous peoples or to try to learn about the ideologies we have? Yeah, I think that's something I would like to share at this point. And one thing is that for politicians, it's actually not only for politicians. As to my observation, a lot of social activists, like social issue activists, they are the same. And of course, if we look at the position, sometimes indigenous people's position will be different, or sometimes even on the opposite side against some social issues. For example, a lot of time, for example, when we are talking about national park, then the ideology of the environmental group will be different from indigenous peoples. But that doesn't mean we cannot discuss about that. So I will have to say, it's just, we are not aliens, you know. So just like people are different and we are one of the different people, then why cannot just, you know, talk to each other and learn from each other and share the different views? And a lot of times, of course, we cannot say like there are 100 things and we have to agree on 100 things. No, it's not possible. But if we don't start talking, then nothing can be agreed upon.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's so true. I mean, I think a lot of times people are really afraid to learn about other people because they're afraid of, you know, being offensive. But it really just starts with a conversation, just being able to connect and listen to people. And, you know, on that note, going forward, you know, what are some of the most pressing challenges facing Indigenous communities in Taiwan right now?
I would say recognition. It's not only like by law to recognize us as indigenous peoples with different, different groups, different nations, but it's more about like to recognize as political entity, and also to really recognize that we do have the rights, and also to have the capacity to reach consensus and to make decisions with our own mechanism. For example, that we have this, there are a lot of like development projects on indigenous land, like with hydropower or with like a lot of green energy projects. They are aiming at indigenous land to develop. And in Taiwan, because of this basic law on indigenous peoples, Article 21, it said that if there's any kind of project that will affect indigenous peoples, then indigenous peoples should be consulted, and the consensus from indigenous peoples should be obtained before the project can be conducted. But with like in reality, it often just become like a voting process. they gather indigenous peoples to tell them that, oh, this project is going to bring you job opportunities, and then it will bring money to the communities, it will bring blah, 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 like all the good things. But a lot of time, it doesn't really mention like the other side of the story. For example, that if they got this part of the land, that means we cannot access to this forest, we cannot go there to hunt, or even there's maybe like our historical site, then we cannot go there anymore, or we have to get permission to go there. Like this kind of thing, they will not tell about, that they will not tell like us. And then it will come to, okay, if you want to, if you say yes, then just raise your hand or just vote on yes and all these things. But for us, it's actually quite violent to vote, even though like in the major or in the mainstream society, people will think voting is voting equals to democracy. But for us, democracy is not voting. A lot of times it's more like to reach consensus, and to reach consensus means we need time, we need the freedom, we need the proper language to explain to us, we need adequate information to really allow us to understand what will be going on, good side, bad side, the future, if affects like, what will happen in the future, 10 years, 20 years, 50 years, all these things. But a lot of time we cannot be given, or we don't have the opportunity to have this time to really understand what is going on. Not to mention, like a lot of development projects were already conducted 20, 30 years ago. At that time, like we didn't even be informed. For example, like the nuclear waste stored in Lanyu, the people on Lanyu, they never know about it. Only after it already happened, then they realized what was going on. And so why I'm mentioning this is that because from the past, that's why I say at the beginning that until now, we're still under colonization because we're still seen as object to the ruling regime, to the government, to the authority. We are not a political entity that hold political rights and also the political status that to be on an equal footing to negotiate with. That's the point. And if we cannot get this kind of recognition as a equal partner or equal subjectivity, if we cannot have this kind of subjectivity, then a lot of violations, a lot of even invasion will keep happen to indigenous peoples, and our rights will still be violated. Doesn't matter how many good laws or legislations have been adopted or be passed in the past years or in the future, it will still be the same. So yeah, I would say this kind of recognition, because it really matters to all these issues we're facing now, not like for all these different natural resources development projects, and also to our participation in politics, even to like election system or mechanism regarding indigenous candidate or indigenous seats in the parliament. It's the same, because we are not recognized as an equal footing entity. Then the idea is still about preserve because we are in a fragile status. And why? In a way, of course, we're in a fragile status, but why? If we cannot remove the factors that make us fragile, but only to make all this protection, then we'll still be fragile or even more fragile. So yeah, I would say this kind of recognition is very important and pressing now.
Sure. Well, Tui, thank you for giving such a great overview and giving so much nuance to this. I think there's a tendency from inside and outside of Taiwan to look at this as a, you know, more simplistic issue than it clearly is. And I think you've done a great job of shedding light on so much of this, you know, historical context, the societal context. And, you know, while it's clear there has been progress, it's clear that there's a lot more to go. And, you know, we'll be very interested to see what the future brings. But we're very glad to have people like you, you know, fighting for this and working so hard on this. So thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
All right. Well, thank you to all our listeners for joining us for another episode of GTI Insights. Many thanks also to the great staff and interns at GTI for all their help with every step of producing this podcast. If you're interested in learning more about GTI, be sure to check out our website at globaltaiwan.org, where you can find information about our Global Taiwan Brief and our frequent public seminars. You can also listen to more episodes of GTI Insights on Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever else you get your podcasts. Until next time, this has been GTI Insights.